Okay, I believe we're ready to go. You can hear me okay? Great. Well, it's a real pleasure to be here today, and I want to thank the organizers for inviting me. I want to begin the talk by just emphasizing how important, as a psychiatrist, I think the session that you've organized is, and how pleased I am to see it happen, because it's focused on an incredibly important problem, both at the level of individuals and their families and society. Because we're talking about an illness that carries a substantial burden. It's a disorder that is common, affecting up to 1% of the population worldwide. It's chronic, with its onset typically in late adolescence or early adulthood, and in the majority of individuals, recovery does not occur. It leaves people among the most vulnerable and fragile members of our society, and it has substantial comorbidity in terms of substance abuse, depression, increased risk for suicide, and independent of the treatments, which can increase risk for cardiovascular disease and diabetes, the illness itself is associated, for reasons that are unclear, with increased risk of those disorders. So as a consequence of these, schizophrenia has the dubious distinction of being one of the most costly illnesses in market economies. Ranks fifth on the list of illnesses in terms of years of life lost to disability and premature mortality. And even in our society today, people with this illness have a lifespan that's only about two-thirds of the general population. Now, I want to approach the illness from a disease process perspective, where ultimately what we'd like to understand about the disorder is, how is it that the etiology, an apparently complex interplay between multiple genetic liabilities and environmental risk factors, how is it that that unleashes pathogenetic mechanisms that result in a pathological entity, a set of disturbances in the brain that so alter the function of the brain that the resulting pathophysiology gives rise to the distinctive the features that compromise the distinctive clinical syndrome. Now, from a scientific perspective, this is an extremely interesting and challenging problem, but from a clinical perspective, it's also critical, because what we would like to do is to develop new treatments that normalize the physiology so that even in the face of the persistence of these upstream factors, the clinical syndrome remits, and ultimately find ways to intervene in preventative measures to prevent the pathogenesis from progressing to the development of the pathology. Now, what I'd like to do today is kind of focus on this end of the spectrum, because unlike many other illnesses, the starting point for schizophrenia, the initial description of the illness, was not based upon a known etiology or a defined pathology, but was based purely upon a cluster of symptoms that co-occurred with a high frequency in certain individuals and defined the clinical syndrome. Now, that clinical syndrome, though, is in itself quite complex. So people with schizophrenia don't have just one characteristic domain of dysfunction. They have multiple domains of dysfunction, including the positive symptoms, hallucinations and delusions, which are typically used to diagnose the illness and which we think about when you hear the term schizophrenia. But there are a number of other abnormalities, including a set of deficits in cognitive processes that appear to be the core features of the illness. And the reason for thinking that the cognition rather than the psychosis is the core of the illness is summarized on this slide. First, cognitive impairments are highly prevalent in the illness. Virtually everyone with the disorder underperforms cognitively compared to what you would have predicted based upon their mother's level of education, which is a good predictor of cognitive performance in the general population. Secondly, these cognitive deficits are present in a milder form in unaffected relatives, suggesting that they may index the genetic liability for the disorder. Third, they are present and in some cases progressive before the onset of psychosis. In particular, working memory, a cognitive ability which I'll talk about later, is normal at age 7 in individuals who will later, 10 or 15 years later, be diagnosed with schizophrenia. At age 7, doesn't differ between healthy controls and subjects who will later develop major depression. But by age 13, people who have not yet been diagnosed with the illness show impaired working memory performance relative to both individuals who will later develop a major depressive disorder and individuals who will not become psychiatrically ill. Fourth, in contrast to the psychosis, which can wax and wane, and in many individuals, quote, burns out later in the illness, the cognitive impairments are persistent across the entire lifespan. And fifth, perhaps most importantly from a treatment perspective, the degree of cognitive impairment is the best predictor of long-term functional outcome. So how well someone with the illness will manage over the course of their life is predicted not by how severe their delusions or hallucinations are when they're diagnosed, but by how cognitively impaired they are. And then six, keeping with this alliteration of P's, at least some of these cognitive abnormalities appear to reflect a product of impaired cortical network oscillations. So for example, here's a study from our center by Ray Cho, in which he gave individuals a task that involved working memory, but also involved cognitive control. And there were two conditions of the task, a low cognitive control and a high cognitive control. And what you can see under the control subjects here is that bilaterally over the frontal lobe, when you compare the high and low control conditions, healthy subjects show an increase in gamma band oscillations, so at 30 to 40 hertz, whereas subjects with schizophrenia doing the same task fail to show this increase in gamma band oscillations. This appears to reflect actually the disease process and not a consequence of having the illness, because Cam Carter's group has recently shown exactly the same thing in individuals who were diagnosed with schizophrenia but had not yet been treated with antipsychotic medications, so early in the course of the illness. So as a starting point to try to understand what's going on, we can say, well, there may be some association between impaired cognitive control and reduced gamma band power in the prefrontal cortex. And so this raises the question of what could be the upstream pathological entity, what could actually be disturbed in the prefrontal cortex that gives rise to this altered physiology and leads to this component of the clinical syndrome. In particular, we want to know what molecular alterations might there be in prefrontal cortical circuitry that could fit in and explain or account for this aspect of the disease process. Well, one way to begin to dissect that is to look at what we know from the non-human primate literature about the circuitry in the prefrontal cortex that is important for both working memory, as illustrated by the studies of the late Patricia Goldman-Rakish, and for gamma band oscillations, as suggested by recent work from Bob Desimone's lab. And these two sets of findings converge upon the importance of circuitry in layer 3, and from both computational and experimental studies suggest that this circuit involving a fast spiking interneuron that contains parvalbumin and pyramidal cells may be critical. And so basically, according to this model, some excitatory input comes into the excitatory pyramidal cell, excites other pyramidal cells, and sets off excitation of a GABA neuron, which provides feedback inhibition to the pyramidal cells. And this actually should have a branch here because these cells are highly diverse in their projections. And what's thought to be part of the mechanism is that these fast-spiking parvalbumin basket cells, by virtue of their diverse connection to multiple pyramidal cells, when they are excited, can uniformly and synchronously hyperpolarize all of the pyramidal cells. Then there's a decay of that inhibition such that all of the pyramidal cells exit the inhibition together and spike together, sending off an afferent excitatory input to the PV basket cell, which in turn hyperpolarizes the pyramidal cell, and the cycle repeats, and so one sees synchrony at a particular frequency that's determined by the decay kinetics of this input, and I'll talk about that in a moment. So one hypothesis in schizophrenia might be that the impairment in synchrony is due to altered GABAergic inhibition from the PV basket cell to the cell body of pyramidal cells. Now, to explore that possibility, we need to think about what's actually critical at that synapse that determines the oscillations. And there appear to be at least three properties. The first is the strength of the GABA neurotransmission. That is the amplitude of the inhibitory postsynaptic current measured in the pyramidal cell. This is in turn dependent upon at least two molecular factors. The first is presynaptic GABA, so how much GABA is present in vesicles available for release when an action potential comes to the axon terminal. And other factor is postsynaptic, and that is how many GABA A receptors are present on the postsynaptic membrane to receive the GABA that's released. The second factor relates to the kinetics of GABA neurotransmission, or in other words, the duration of the inhibitory postsynaptic current. And here, one of the key factors molecularly that regulates that is the subunit composition of the postsynaptic GABA A receptors, because they determine the decay kinetics of the iPSC. And then third, the polarizing nature of GABA neurotransmission, which is determined in part by the direction and magnitude of chloride ion flow through the GABA A receptor when these receptors are activated. So at least three different properties that we can explore in individuals with schizophrenia to ask, could any of these be altered in the illness in a way that could impair GABA neurotransmission from the parvalbumin basket cell to the pyramidal cell and account for the disturbances and oscillations and potentially then the disturbances in cognition? So the question is, are there molecular markers of the strength, kinetics, or nature of GABA neurotransmission that are altered in the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex of individuals with schizophrenia? Now, as powerful as in vivo imaging techniques have become, they still lack the level of resolution required to examine individual molecules in the context of the circuits that they form in the brain. And so the only available means we have to assess that directly in the disease right now is through the use of postmortem human tissue. And that ties into one of the mantras that I'm always saying to my research trainees: when the disease process is at issue, the answer is in the tissue. And so we conduct postmortem human studies. And I want to look at three of these studies where we've attempted to measure things that involve presynaptic strength, postsynaptic strength and kinetics, and the polarizing nature of GABA neurotransmission through these GABA A receptors. So we know from the presynaptic side that a critical factor is the amount of a GABA that's available for release. And in the cortex, GABA synthesis is determined principally by the expression of, not by the translation, but by the expression of a messenger RNA from the GAD1 gene, which encodes for an enzyme called glutamic acid decarboxylase 67. And perhaps the most consistently and widely replicated observation in postmortem studies of schizophrenia, and I almost say in any observation of schizophrenia, is that the level of this transcript, the level of the messenger RNA for GAD67, which synthesizes GABA, is lower in individuals with schizophrenia. This slide is only a partial summary of work from multiple labs using multiple different techniques in different cohorts of subjects with schizophrenia, but all converge on exactly the same finding: on average, less GAD67 message in the prefrontal cortex. Here's an example. Yes, sir.
On a point of information, is that true in temporal lobe as well as in prefrontal cortex?
So, great question. And been less extensively studied in other regions, but where it has been studied, such as in the temporal cortex, has been found to be the case. We've done one study, I think it's the only study in the literature, that looked at, in the same subjects, at four different cortical regions. And even though the level of GAD67 normally differs across those regions, the deficit in schizophrenia was the same across regions. That has not been examined yet, but the regions that were examined were prefrontal, anterior cingulate, primary motor, and primary visual. as well as in another study, primary auditory. So it would be a reasonable speculation that this is a pancortical as opposed to a regionally restricted disturbance. So in this most recent study, what's plotted here for 42 matched pairs of people with schizophrenia or schizoaffective disorder and control subjects, each symbol represents the value for both the comparison subject and the schizophrenia subject. This is the unity line. So all values below that line means that the individual with schizophrenia has less GAD-67 than its comparator subject. So you can see that there are some individuals with schizophrenia who don't apparently have this abnormality, but most do. Yeah, on average, it's, yeah. In this particular case, all comers, it was 15%. But if you take those individuals who just were lower than their normal controls, then it turns out to be those individuals average closer to a 30% reduction. One of the potential confounds of postmortem human studies is, of course, is it the illness that accounts for the abnormality, or is it something that co-varies with the illness? And two of the things that one has to be concerned about in this regard are other substances that individuals with schizophrenia might use, either illicit or commonly available ones like nicotine or prescribed medications. What's plotted here is the GAD-67 level for every subject with schizophrenia as a function of whether or not they had this potential confounding factor. And if you look at the mean values here, you can see that they're virtually identical across all of these. Suggestive, but not conclusive, of the interpretation that the abnormality of GAD-67 is related to the disease process and is not explicable by other factors that co-vary with the illness. But the messenger RNA doesn't make GABA. It codes for the protein that does. And so the question is, to what extent is the message deficit actually present at the level of the protein that synthesizes GABA? And so to look at that, Allison Curley took a subset of the subjects I've just shown you, selected based upon having a postmortem interval, that is the time between death and when the brain was preserved, that was relatively short, and within a time window in which experimental studies showed that GAD-67 protein did not degrade. And so this is the subject cohort, and what she found here was a deficit in GAD-67 protein in total cortex, total prefrontal cortex, that was quite similar to that observed at the level of the messenger RNA and which tended to correlate with the deficit in messenger RNA. But what we knew from previous studies is that we couldn't just measure things at the level of total tissue because, of course, the brain is not a homogeneous structure that just operates that way. It's composed of multiple different cell types. And earlier studies had shown that the GAD-67 message deficit was restricted to a subset of GABA neurons. About 25% of GABA neurons had levels of GAD-67 that were not detectable with the available technique, and the other 75% had normal levels of GAD-67. And subsequent work by Takinori Hashimoto showed that the deficit in GAD-67 message was at least present in the parvalbumin-containing class of GABA neurons. And so this raised the question of, are the GAD-67 protein levels altered in the axon terminals of PV basket cells? Because, of course, it's the presence of the GAD-67 enzymatic activity in the axon terminal that makes GABA, that loads the vesicles, that regulates GABA neurotransmission. And so to address that question, we used a confocal imaging technique where we could look at four different labels in the brain simultaneously. The gray level here is the Nissl stain, and this is the cell body of a pyramidal neuron, and here's its membrane. The red is GAD, the blue is parvalbumin, and the green is a particular type of GABA-A receptor that contains an alpha-1 subunit, which is known to be postsynaptic to the inputs from parvalbumin basket cells. So if you look here, you can see a purple terminal, meaning that it has both GAD and parvalbumin, and it's directly opposed to an alpha-1 cluster in the membrane of a pyramidal cell, meaning that this is very likely a synaptic input from a parvalbumin basket cell to a pyramidal cell in postmortem human brain. And with this technique, Ken Fish validated the technique by showing that relative levels of GAD67 and 65 differed across the axon terminals of different populations of GABA neurons in the cortex. And then we took it to the human level, and in the initial study, Allison found that in the terminals of parvalbumin basket cells, GAD67 protein levels were reduced to about 50% of the control value, and this deficit was 5 to 10 times greater than the deficit that was observed when we looked at total tissue. So strongly suggesting that the GAD67 deficit is very pronounced in a subpopulation of GABA neurons that includes the parvalbumin-containing basket cells. So we have suggestion then at this point that in this axon terminal from a parvalbumin-containing basket cell, there's less GAD67, and so presynaptic strength may be reduced, and maybe that accounts for the problem that leads to the oscillatory disturbance. But what happens at postsynaptic strength and kinetics? So as I mentioned earlier, the density of GABA-A receptors contributes to the postsynaptic strength, that is the amplitude of the iPSC, but the GABA-A receptor subunit composition determines the decay kinetics, or the iPSC duration. And in particular, receptors that contain alpha-1 subunits generate iPSCs that decay much faster than those that contain the other predominant alpha subunits, alpha-2 or alpha-5, in the cortex. And because the iPSC duration is inversely proportional to the frequency of the network oscillation, that is, the longer the pyramidal cells are inhibited, the slower the oscillation, gamma frequency requires alpha-1 subunits with fast-decaying iPSCs, and this is exactly the type of subunit that's postsynaptic to the fast-spiking PD-containing basket cells. And at this location, those particular type of receptors also tend to contain a beta-2 subunit. So what happens to GABA-A receptor expression in schizophrenia? Well, what's plotted here qualitatively are control subjects and subjects with schizophrenia. This is the peel surface. This is the underlying white matter. Four different GABA-A receptor subunits. And on the right are quantitative analyses of these across the layers of the cortex, so from top to bottom here, in 19 matched pairs of schizophrenia and control subjects. And notice that in layers 3 and 4, GABA-A alpha-1 and the subunit that it co-assembles with, beta-2, both show about an 18% decrease relative to the subjects, the comparison subjects, whereas alpha-2 in schizophrenia is actually increased in the more superficial layers, and alpha-5 is decreased, but only in the deep layers. So to examine the alpha-1 expression abnormality at a better level of resolution, Jill Glaucier moved to an alternative technique where she was able to label two different messenger RNAs at the same time. In the panel on the left, she used CAM kinase 2, labeled with doxygenin, which is this background purple stain, and this identifies pyramidal cells. So the circles indicate silver grains, which is alpha-1 expression, over the cell bodies of pyramidal cells. Notice that there's also a cluster of silver grains here where there's no digoxygenin label, indicating that this is a GABA neuron or a non-pyramidal cell that also expresses alpha-1. The alternative way of doing this is to use another form of glutamic acid decarboxylase 65, which is not altered in schizophrenia, which labels interneurons. And here you can see two interneurons that contain the alpha-1 message and two clusters that are larger, presumably pyramidal cells, that also contain the message. So this made it possible to selectively quantify the level of GABA-A alpha-1 messenger RNA in pyramidal cells and GABA neurons. And what Jill observed was that in the same subjects of schizophrenia in the prefrontal cortex, there was a marked deficit, on average about 40%, of GABA-A alpha-1 message in the pyramidal cells, but absolutely no difference in expression in the interneurons. So a cell type selective deficit in the expression of a message for GABA-A receptors that appear to be critical for gamma oscillations. So to summarize, then, we found lower levels of both alpha-1 and beta-2 message, and even larger deficits of alpha-1, specifically in layer 3 pyramidal cells, suggesting a postsynaptic deficit in GABA neurotransmission from PV basket neurons. The absence of an upregulation of other GABA-A receptor subunits suggests that what's happening is that there are actually fewer receptors rather than just different types of receptors due to some type of subunit substitution. And so these findings would be consistent with a decrement in the postsynaptic strength, but not in the kinetics of GABA neurotransmission from PV basket cells to pyramidal cells in schizophrenia. And they would be consistent with the observations I showed you earlier, that it looks like it's the power and not the frequency of gamma oscillations that's altered in the prefrontal cortex in schizophrenia in the context of cognitive control tasks. So now we had started out with the idea that it could be this or it could be that, but so far we have evidence that maybe it's both. Well, what about chloride transport and the polarizing nature of GABA neurotransmission? Well, we know that the generation-efficient network oscillations require strongly hyperpolarizing inputs to pyramidal cells, and the polarizing nature of GABA neurotransmission depends upon the intracellular concentration of chloride, because that will determine whether when the GABA-A receptor channels are open, chloride flows into the cell and how strongly, or whether it actually flows out of the cell. And the intracellular concentration of chloride is determined, in turn, by two types of chloride transporters that are located in the membrane of the pyramidal cell. The sodium-potassium chloride cotransporter takes chloride and pushes it into the cell, and the chloride-potassium cotransporter 2 extrudes chloride from the cell. So it's thought early in development that this is the predominant transporter, and then later on with development, this one comes on and converts GABA from being depolarizing to hyperpolarizing. Both of these transporters are regulated by phosphorylation, but in the opposite direction. So if you add phosphate groups to this transporter, you'll increase chloride transport into the cell. If you activate or if you add phosphate groups to this transporter, you'll inhibit it, and that will serve the same thing as not extruding chloride from the cell. So it's possible then that altered expression of either these transporters or the kinases that regulate them could contribute or could to alterations in the hyperpolarizing nature of inputs to pyramidal cells. So just to summarize, here's the two transporters in the membrane. This one pushes it in. This one pushes chloride out. They're regulated by kinases. In the adult brain, the ratio is shifted, so there's little chloride that goes in, a lot that's pushed out. And so when GABA-A receptors are activated by GABA, chloride flows down a concentration gradient into the cell and hyperpolarizes it. So to examine the question of interest, we looked at the expression of the two transporters and a number of kinases that regulate them. And what we observed in this study was that the expression of both of the transporters was only slightly and barely significantly altered in the case of NKCC1 in schizophrenia. But two of the kinases, OXSR1 and WNT3, were markedly increased in expression. And this was an important finding because everything I've showed you so far has been a decrement in expression. And so you might begin to think, well, there's just something wrong with the brains and all of the messenger RNAs are underexpressed or degrade. But no, here are two that are heavily upregulated. And also notice that these are present in 41 out of 42, and 37 out of 42 subjects show this upregulation. So a highly consistently observed abnormality. And we tried to look at this at the protein level, and we found that OXSR1 is heavily expressed in layer 3 pyramidal cells. Unfortunately, this protein decays fairly rapidly with the postmortem interval, so we couldn't quantify the protein levels. But we did carve out individual layer 3 pyramidal cells and found that the transcripts for both OXSR1 and Wnt3 were upregulated in layer 3 pyramidal cells in schizophrenia. So in contrast to the normal state, what may be happening in schizophrenia is due to increased levels of these two kinases, there is a hyperphosphorylation of both NKCC1 and KCC2, which activates NKCC1, driving chloride into the cell, deactivates KCC2, so the extrusion of chloride is reduced, and that means when GABA-A receptors are open by GABA, less chloride will flow into the cell. So I started off by raising the question of maybe one of these three factors could be altered and could account for the oscillatory disturbances, but we have an abundance of riches in that they're all altered. So how do we begin to explain that? Well, in order to try to get a handle on it, we did one additional study that David Volk did, which was to ask another question about the regulation of GABA release from parvalbumin basket cells in schizophrenia. And in this case, these cells contain, on both their cell body and their axon terminals, a receptor for opioids, of the mu opioid receptor. When this receptor on the cell body is activated, it hyperpolarizes the PB cells, making them less likely to fire an action potential. When the receptor on the terminals is activated, it suppresses GABA release. So in both cases, it looks like a mechanism to downregulate or suppress GABA neurotransmission from PD basket cells. So we looked at the expression of this receptor in schizophrenia, and what David Volk found was a marked 27% on average increase in the expression of the mu opioid receptor in people with schizophrenia in the prefrontal cortex. In contrast, other markers of this opioid signaling system, the delta opioid receptor, or the precursor for the ligand, were not altered in schizophrenia. So together, these four findings suggest that first, there's less GAD67 in the axon terminals of parvalbumin basket cells, which would be consistent with the idea of lower presynaptic strength. Less GABA made, less GABA released. Postsynaptically, there appear to be fewer GABA-A alpha-1 beta-2 containing receptors, which would be consistent with a lower postsynaptic strength of GABA neurotransmission, but without an alteration in kinetics. Third, we predict that there would be increased intracellular chloride levels, which would mean that when GABA-A receptors are activated, less chloride will flow into the cell, and there will be less hyperpolarization. And fourth, there are more mu opioid receptors on the GABA terminals, suggesting that there would be a greater suppression of GABA release. So in contrast to where we started with, was the idea that maybe there would be one factor related to this synapse that could be altered in a way that could explain a reduction in power of gamma oscillations. Everything that we've looked at is consistent with that. So this leads to two potential interpretations. One is that each of these findings represents a different upstream pathology. That is, a different route that could lead to an impairment in parvalbumin basket cell inhibition and reduce gamma band power in schizophrenia. And that might be fit if you thought that there are four different types of schizophrenia. Each one has a different upstream factor. But given that most of these are observed in the same subjects of schizophrenia, a more parsimonious explanation is that they're all compensatory responses to downregulate inhibition in response to an upstream deficit in pyramidal neuron excitation. So the question was, is the upstream problem deficient inhibition here, or is it deficient excitation here or here? Well, the latter hypothesis is supported by observations, again from multiple research groups, that dendritic spines on pyramidal cells, which receive most of the excitatory inputs to pyramidal cells, are lower in number, especially on layer 3, within layer 3 of the prefrontal cortex. So this is a Golgi image from a control subject. You can see lots of nice dendritic spines. Two extreme examples from individuals with schizophrenia where the number of dendritic spines is markedly reduced. On average, in layer 3 of the prefrontal cortex, people with schizophrenia have about a 20% reduction in dendritic spine density relative to both healthy comparison subjects and subjects with other psychiatric conditions, mostly major depressive disorder with psychosis. And notice that this deficit is most marked in deep layer 3 and appears to be absent on pyramidal neurons located in layers 5 and 6. So this leads to a provisional interpretation of the data I presented, that is that in the layer 3 of the prefrontal cortex, the upstream pathology in the illness is a deficit in the number of excitatory inputs to pyramidal neuron dendritic spines. As a consequence of that, overall neural activity would be reduced in layer 3 circuitry, and we predict then that homeostatic mechanisms kick in to produce multiple downstream compensations in PV cell basket cell inhibition of layer 3 pyramidal neurons, all of which reduce the feedback inhibition from those cells in an attempt to restore excitatory inhibitory balance. So excitation is markedly reduced, compensatory mechanisms kick in to reduce inhibition accordingly. But at this, quote, reset EI balance, we would predict that both the excitation of PV basket cells and their inhibition of pyramidal cells are too low to achieve normal gamma band power under conditions of high working memory load or in context of cognitive control tasks. So just to summarize this schematically, here's the circuit I showed you earlier. And one way to think about this is that the upstream, not necessarily the primary cause of schizophrenia, but upstream in the disease process, is on pyramidal cells, a reduction in the density of dendritic spines. That would lead to then an impairment in recurrent excitation in the network and would be compensated for by postsynaptically here a reduction in the density of GABA A receptors, presynaptically by a reduction in the synthesis of GABA, overall then resulting in reduced feedback inhibition. But now in a context where still, even though EI may be more balanced, there's insufficient activity in this network to generate strong gamma band oscillations. Now, I've reduced the circuit to 2 neurons, and if only the brain were like that. But let me just show you other things that we need to account for, and that is other populations of GABA neurons, one of which is the chandelier cell. Chandelier cells exclusively innervate the axon initial segment of pyramidal neurons. And we know in schizophrenia that chandelier cell inputs to the pyramidal neuron axon initial segments in layers 2 and 3 have lower presynaptic levels of the GABA membrane transporter GAT1, which is responsible for the reuptake of GABA into the terminal after it's been released. And in contrast to the situation postsynaptic to the parvalbumin basket cells, postsynaptic to the chandelier cells, there is an increase in GABA-A receptors that contain an alpha-2 subunit. So this combination of leaving GABA out in the synaptic cleft longer and making it more probable to interact with the GABA-A receptor would strengthen GABA neurotransmission at these synapses. Well, this was problematic for a while until recent studies came out that shown that actually at these synapses, in quiescent circuits, GABA neurotransmission is not hyperpolarizing, but it's depolarizing. And so it's possible, at least theoretically so, that these alterations in chandelier cell inputs to pyramidal cells could also reflect a circuit-level compensatory response to enhance pyramidal cell excitation in a circuit that's deficient in excitation. So just to walk you through this schematic again, we have the alterations in spines, the postsynaptic compensations in PV basket cells to try to balance less excitation with less inhibition. And then what's going on here is that postsynaptically, the number of GABA-A receptors is greater in schizophrenia. Presynaptically, the amount of GAT1 is reduced, so that GABA neurotransmission would be predicted to be increased here, leading to an increased depolarization at this and potentially a way to further augment excitatory activity in the circuit. So if this is true, and there's a lot of ifs associated with that, what we would predict would be that there is a reset excitatory inhibitory balance in schizophrenia at lower levels of both excitation and inhibition, that we'd be predicted to have now less dynamic range for adjusting either excitation or inhibition in the face of new forces that alter one or the other. And this might be helpful in explaining some of the clinical phenomena in schizophrenia. For example, we know robustly that when people with schizophrenia are stressed, and we know from studies from Amy Arnstein and others that stress impairs prefrontal cortical activity, that they get symptomatically worse. So perhaps the reason that they can't accommodate to stress in the same way that others can is because they can't make the adjustments in EI balance in the cortex that normals can. Secondly, we know that the cognitive deficits in schizophrenia worsen during the prodrome, right before people become psychotic. And this is temporally associated with the adolescence-related pruning of excitatory synapses in layer 3. So perhaps the reason that they worsen during adolescence is that they already have impaired excitation, and when you further reduce excitation by pruning spines and their inputs, you see decompensation. And third, we know that people with schizophrenia get worse when they smoke marijuana. And marijuana can suppress both GABA and glutamate release in the cortex. So perhaps providing a mechanism for why, if you impair in an already vulnerable system excitation or inhibition, things get clinically worse. So just to summarize that in a schematic form, what we want to look at here is kind of net prefrontal cortical network activity. This would be the normal range. If you have too much inhibition, you go into coma. If you have too much excitation relative to inhibition, you get seizures. So within the normal range, we can think about three categories. A category that's appropriate for normal cognition, a category where cognition would be impaired, and a category where cognition is so impaired that it's insufficient to control or regulate behavior. So if we look at the relationship between excitation and inhibition under these conditions, we would say that on the normal, healthy brain, there's a capacity for homeostatic excitatory-inhibitory balance. So if excitation goes up for some reason, inhibition can be adjusted upward to bring down the net level so that they are rebalanced. And the opposite would happen. Excitation goes down, inhibition can follow and rebalance. In an allostatic state, such as what might be the case in the premorbid or prodromal phase of schizophrenia, before people develop delusions and hallucinations, what we would predict is that there is some marked decrease in excitation due to a deficiency in dendritic spines that requires a marked reduction in inhibition, invoking the mechanisms that I've showed you earlier, and you still get balance, but now it's at a level that's so altered that impairment in cognition occurs. And then finally, clinical decompensation and the syndromal symptoms of schizophrenia occur when some other insult perhaps further impairs excitation, and now inhibition cannot further downregulate to adjust to that, and you get a marked state of EI balance, imbalance, and severe behavioral problems. So we leave it at that point and acknowledge the individuals I've been privileged to work with in these studies. Dominique, Ken, Monica, Allison, Jill, and David did the all of the studies that I presented to you in terms of the tissue-based studies. We appreciate the support from the National Institute of Mental Health, and I want to acknowledge and thank the many family members who at a very difficult time in their lives generously gave consent for brain tissue donation from their deceased loved ones, and then very patiently worked with us in our extensive diagnostic interviews. Without their support and help, these studies would not be possible. So again, thank you very much for your attention.
We have about 5 minutes for questions. I wanted to ask,
seems more parsimonious to consider that there's just one cause, but for a lot of diseases with high morbidity and mortality, it's simply speculative that there may be the many causes coming together in order to produce this disease that otherwise, if it was a single gene, would probably be eliminated from the population. Do you think perhaps the affected family individuals might have one or two of these, whereas the patients with schizophrenia have got the bunch that came together?
Yes, it's a really interesting question. I would suggest that there may be multiple, if the dendritic spine abnormality and the excitatory input abnormality is the upstream event, there are multiple ways to get that. Yeah, yeah. And certainly, you know, I haven't shown you the data, but we and others have, you know, made observations about molecular factors that regulate spine maintenance that are altered in the illness, some of which, like Calorin-7, have been implicated in association studies as risk genes for schizophrenia. In my view, the heterogeneity at the etiological side of schizophrenia may be multiplex, but that there may be a convergence of those onto a less heterogeneous pathology, which I've tried to illustrate today, which then leads to some heterogeneity in the clinical syndrome based upon the background cognitive substrate of the individual that's afflicted. John.
The fundamental view that you're posing here is that the E to I balance as represented by gamma as a continuum, and something that gets there before you have a disease, and then at the point of psychosis, it gets much worse. So I think the several things I'd like to say about that. First of all, the deficit in gamma, which now everyone agrees is present before you get the disease, is not tremendously devastating. I mean, you obviously have some cognitive deficits, but you aren't mentally confused. You got into college. So we're talking about a relatively mild cognitive impairment from the point of view of this change in gamma. So then the question is it just slightly worse gamma that gets you into real trouble with psychosis, or is it something that is fundamentally different but which may be caused by or given a propensity by the abnormality in gamma? And I guess I'll present to you that maybe it is just worse gamma but something fundamentally different. I'd like to mention one more thing, and that is this idea that, oh, it's really a problem in working memory as a result of the change in gamma, I find problematical because, I mean, psychiatrists tell me my patients walk into the office, they remember everything about the last session, and in fact, they told me the same damn story about the CIA in their tooth.
I'll give you the respond to both of those. So the first part is, I would, you know, suggest that what's happening in this situation is much more than impairments in gamma, because there are many more aspects to clinical impairment in schizophrenia that cannot be accounted for solely by deficits in working memory or cognitive control. On the other hand, I would suggest to you even going back to Bleuler, who coined the term schizophrenia, in his view of schizophrenia, the core feature of the illness was loosening of associations, the inability to keep in mind what you've just thought or said so that what you're about to say or think will follow logically. And one of the key ways of diagnosing people with schizophrenia is not just what they tell you about what they believe or what they hear when it's not there, but about their capacity to engage fundamental processes like working memory to communicate in a logical fashion. In fact, a great bit of a disability for individuals with schizophrenia is that they can't keep in mind something. They can't follow directions. They can't remember a six-step process. And in severe cases, or in many cases, they get loosening of associations or total derailment, so that when you talk with an individual with schizophrenia, you hear every word they said, but you cannot make a bit of sense how, when they started with point A, they got to point B or point C or point D.
might be related to the onset of the GABA seizure. And that's generally consistent with what you've been saying. But you didn't actually say that. So would you like to sort of just review for us whether there's any evidence, and probably it's jolly hard to come by, that the decrease of GABA is associated with the onset of the problem?
No, so great question. When does the alteration in GABA occur relative to the onset of the positive symptoms? And the bottom line question to that is that we don't know. Right, because all of the studies that we've done are in individuals who've had the illness for a while. So I think answering that question is going to require either the kind of thing that John alluded to, which is using a surrogate measure for GABA, like gamma oscillations, and measuring in individuals who are at heightened risk for the illness and follow them over time until they convert and see whether they have the abnormality, or to use other methods which can in vivo measure GABA levels and see whether they're present earlier on. And I think those answers will emerge. My prediction is that there is some level of GABA circuitry alteration that is there well before the onset of psychosis and that accounts for the premorbid impairments and in working memory that progress over time.
Well, let's continue the discussion over coffee, and then thank the speaker again. And,